Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today, on this special Veterans Day edition of Main Street, we pause to honor the extraordinary courage and dedication of our nation's veterans. It's a day of gratitude, reflection, and remembrance for the sacrifices made by the men and women who have served to protect the freedoms we hold dear. As part of our tribute, we're bringing you a story that embodies the spirit and resilience of the American soldier. Earlier this year at the Fargo Air Museum's History Night, World War II veteran First Lieutenant Rolf Slenn, who just celebrated his 100th birthday, shared his captivating memories as a navigator aboard the B-24 Liberator during World War II. His story, moderated by Max Sabin at the Fargo Air Museum, is a vivid account of bravery, camaraderie, and the enduring spirit that defines our nation's heroes. Today, we re-air his unforgettable presentation, honoring the legacy of those who served during World War II and all who have since answered the call of duty. Thank you, veterans. Your sacrifices are forever etched in our nation's heart.
Rolf, it is truly an honor to have you here. Thank you for your time and for your service. Where are you originally from?
I'm originally from Madison, Minnesota. Madison, Minnesota is approximately 150 miles south of Moorhead.
What was it like growing up there in the 1930s?
Many of you know the 1930s were tough economic times. We were just kids. We didn't think much of that. We played the same game. We got a little older. We played baseball, pump, pump, pull away. But we played all the games that kids play. We got a little older. We shot pheasant and ducks and huge amounts of pheasants out in Madison, Minnesota in those days.
Tell us about your family. Did you have any military veterans that had served prior to World War II?
Yeah, my dad was in World War I. He was wounded slightly in that war. I had a younger brother, a year younger than I. He got trench foot in World War II, recovered very well from it. My wife's family also has military people. Her father was about 35 when he served in World War II. When I was about 19, serving in World War II, she also had a grandson who was severely injured in Afghanistan. So we've had military people on both sides of our respective families. I finished high school in Madison, Minnesota, May of 1942. World War II started really in 1941, as you all remember. The Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. I was a 17-year-old high school student at the time. I didn't have the vaguest notion of where Pearl Harbor was. It was somewhere out in the vast Pacific. I didn't know much about it. And then I finished in 1942.
Do you remember what you were doing or where you were when you heard that Pearl Harbor had been attacked?
Yeah, I sure do. It was a Sunday. We heard it over the radio. There weren't any television sets at the time. I went to church that evening, a Luther League meeting, and one of my brother's classmates was going to play the piano at this meeting, and she apologized before she played it because she didn't realize it when she prepared it, but the name of the piano that she, a piano concert that she played was Japanese Lullaby. She wasn't sure that was appropriate when the Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor.
So tell us about your induction into the armed forces. Were you drafted or did you enlist?
Well, I enlisted. As I say, I graduated from high school in May of 1942. During the summer of 1942, I worked on various projects out in western Nebraska, building barracks, earning 50 cents an hour, saved up some money to go to St. Olaf College in the fall of 1942. St. Olaf is a small college south of Minneapolis, about 40 miles. So I started the college in 1942, September. And then, if you remember, well, you probably don't, but in November of 1942, the Americans invaded or landed in Africa. Maybe you'll remember this from your history books. So I got kind of excited. I kind of thought, I think I'll join that war too. I was 18, and believe it or not, I had to get my parents' permission to join the what I hoped would be the Army Air Force. They gave me permission. I joined technically, I guess, in November of 1942, finished that semester, first semester at St. Olaf College, and then almost immediately they called me up to Fort Snelling in the Twin Cities and swore me in for good. And that was really the beginning of my active duty in the armed services.
So what was basic training like in the 1940s, and where was it?
Well, let me tell you a story about that. We took a train trip down from Fort Snelling down to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, which was a camp just south of St. Louis. That camp was very cold and dirty and muddy. The train took us right into a siding that went right into the camp. I remember looking down from the train, and there were some guys down below that yelled up at us and said, "You ain't gonna like it here." And we didn't like it there very well either. I looked over, and here was a building not too far from us that said, "All hope abandon, ye who enter here." That was not a very pleasant way of being introduced to active duty. We finally got our uniforms, and we learned to march, close order drill, all that kind of stuff. We were there about 6 or 7 weeks. From there, we went to a small Jesuit college called Rockhurst College in Kansas City, Missouri. And we went there to get 10 hours of basic instruction and learning to be a pilot in a Piper Cub. I was not very good at coordinating my feet and arms and legs with flying a Piper Cub, and I flunked out, washed out as a for pilot training. And I remember at the time I was kind of happy I did, because I wasn't any good at landing and taking off in a Piper Cub. So they classified me thereafter as a track to be a navigator.
After being selected as a navigator, what was that training like? Was it at the same base? What did they teach you there?
No, the navigation school was out in Hondo, Texas. But before I even went to navigation school, I went to aerial gunnery school. I learned to be an aerial gunner down in Harlingen, Texas, and that was kind of fun. I was pretty good at shooting a shotgun at the time because I'd done a lot of pheasant hunting out in Madison. Some of the guys from New York had never fired a gun before, so they had more trouble. We shot skeet and trap, and we shot at a sleeve that was pulled by an airplane. Somehow or other, I became an aerial gunner. I learned how to take apart and put together a 50 caliber machine gun blindfolded. I remember that was quite a thing to do.
I know when we had spoken in the past, you had mentioned that at Navigator School, they taught you several different ways of navigating, especially in an aircraft as large as a B-24. Do you want to talk about those different methods?
Yeah, as I say, I went to navigation school for 16 weeks, Hondo, Texas. Hondo was about 100 miles west of San Antonio, as I remember. That was very intense. There was very intense training. We learned all about meteorology and how to find your location by celestial navigation and radios, pilotage. Pilotage was simply a method of looking down at the ground and finding out where you were. But the most important method of navigation that we learned was what was called dead reckoning. Dead reckoning is a process by where you, by looking at your maps, you know exactly where your target is or where your destination is, but you have to make corrections. Many of you know, or maybe you don't know, a compass doesn't point to the North Pole. Many people tell you that a compass points due north. It doesn't. It points to the North Magnetic Pole, which isn't the same thing as the North Geographic Pole. So you have to make corrections for that. But the biggest correction you have to make on every flight you ever fly is a correction for wind. You never can get anywhere today or anywhere else without knowing which way the wind is blowing. You never get a direct headwind or a direct tailwind. The wind is always pushing you from the left or the right. And the way you determine the amount of way in which your plane is being pushed off course is by a drift meter. Every B-24 that I ever flew on absolutely needed and had a drift meter. This was probably the most important instrument you had in flying over water.
After completing navigation training, when did you meet your crew that you would go overseas with?
After finishing navigation training, I became, by magic of military protocol, I became a second lieutenant. And then I got a 10-day leave at home in Madison, Minnesota. I went there to see my folks and sisters. After that 10-day leave, I went to an Air Force base, Army Air Force base, down in Arizona. I got off the train and I asked somebody for where the bachelor officers' quarters were. Unfortunately, I finally found them, but unfortunately, the guy that I asked directions from later became my co-pilot. And he had a lot of fun, and so did the others, talking about their new navigator who looked awfully young and couldn't find his way on land, and how in the world would he be able to find his way in the air? So I started out at a disability. I met my whole crew there at that time. We really got along very well.
We actually have then the picture pulled up right behind us. Do you remember their names and what positions they would have been on the aircraft?
Oh, absolutely. I lived with these guys. We darned, there they are. They're all dead now except me. Off to the left in back is my pilot. He was from Montgomery, Minnesota. Next to him in the back was the co-pilot from Superior, Wisconsin. Then I'm the next one in the middle in the back. The next one to the right, I was from Providence, Rhode Island. He was a bombardier. In my opinion, he was the best bombardier in the whole Army Air Force, but I might have been a little prejudiced. The last one in back on the right was the flight engineer. He worked a lot with the pilot in transferring gasoline from one wing to the other. I know all these guys, knew them all very well. On the left, down below the pilot, he was a top turret gunner. He sat right above me, really, and to my left. The guy next to him was from New Mexico. He was a tail gunner. The middle guy in the bottom there, Al Emery, was a nose gunner. And next to him was the old man on the crew. He was 28 years old. He was a belly gunner. Way off to the right on the bottom was a radio operator. These are all very good friends of mine.
Yeah, it's truly fascinating that after all these years, you still remember what positions they were in. That is absolutely incredible. Following meeting your entire crew, did you know where you were going right away?
At some time during our training together as a crew, this crew here, we were told we were going to the Pacific. And I remember feeling a lot of relief because the news that was coming out of Europe was terrible. Many, many B-24s, B-17s were being shot down by German AK-AK guns, and many were being shot down by German fighters. And we were very relieved we were not going there, and we were happy we were going to be assigned to the Pacific.
So tell us about your flight over water. Were any special modifications made to your B-24?
Well, okay, I will. That was kind of exciting. I don't know how many of you know this. Maybe many of you do. It's about 2,500 statute miles between the Golden Gate Bridge and Hickam Field in the Hawaiian Islands. There ain't a bit of land in between. It's all water. And I was a navigator who had flown very little over water. They told us, before we took off, told the navigators anyway, that the wind would be from the north, fairly strong. And I had to build that into my computation in what direction to tell the pilot where to fly. The wind was a lot stronger than we realized. And when I got, maybe 4 or 5 hours out from the land in California, I took my celestial instrument out and measured got a sun line from the sun that was shining, and I got a signal from a little picket boat down below, and when those two lines crossed, that was my location. And to my horror, we were approximately 100 miles off course. The wind had been much stronger than we thought, and there was no way I could have figured that out until I got this location with celestial navigation and radio operation. So I told the pilot, corrected him, just a very little bit to the right. I didn't tell him we were 100 miles off course. I didn't think he'd appreciate that. We corrected his our direction slightly, and then hours went by, and I found out that we were approximately on course. Corrected the direction again a little bit, and some hours went by. Then my co-pilot called me up and told me, look out to the left. Here are the mountains on the big island of Hawaii, Mauna Lea and Mauna Kea, I think it is. Those big, tall mountains stood up through the clouds. We were real happy to see them. The whole flight took approximately 14 and a half hours. Today, I think they fly from San Francisco to Hawaii in 4 or 5, I don't know what. I didn't sleep a wink on that during that 14 hours because I was very concerned about getting there. But we got there, we landed, we had a lot of gas left in the tanks that had been installed in the Bombay. Then what happened was we got to Hawaii, Oahu, but our base was over on the island of Kauai, is about 100 miles west of Honolulu. It's the westernmost island in the Hawaiian Islands. And we were at a base there called Barking Sands Air Base. We spent 5 months there doing some more training, but basically we were waiting for a base where we could be based way down the line from there and fly combat missions against Japanese targets. It took a long time for the military to find enough places for us to land and be functioning as a 494th bomb group.
So did you have a particular B-24 Liberator assigned to you? And if so, what was its name?
Yeah, there was a plane assigned to us. Incidentally, the 494th Bomb Group was composed of 4 squadrons. Each squadron had 12 airplanes, so a total of 48 B-24s. We were assigned one of those B-24s. We had it christened and labeled as the Lonesome Lady. Lonesome Lady. Oh, that's a good one. It's not an erotic picture. I think it's very well done. As you can see, it's a naked woman on a raft in the middle of the Pacific with her bra as a sail. I thought it's, we thought it was a terrific picture. We flew that very plane most of the time during our career bombing Japanese targets in the Pacific.
Do you recall your first combat mission?
I remember how nervous I was the night before we had to fly our first mission. I had no idea what it would be like to fly in a B-24 with people shooting at you or whatever they were going to do to us. Now, I've got to explain a little bit. We flew down a chain of islands to the Palau Islands, P-A-L-A-U. The Palau Islands were about 600-800 miles from the Philippine Islands. That was our base for approximately 7 months. Yeah, sure, I was nervous. I didn't know what to think. Now, I have to explain a little bit about the Palau Islands for you to understand this. The Palau Islands were a series of islands running north and south, 700-800 miles from the Philippines. The island in the Palau Islands, where we were based, was an island called Angaur, A-N-G-A-U-R. 30 miles north of us, in the Palau Islands, were 30,000 Japanese troops. Now, we, on our first mission, were to bomb installations involving these 30,000 Japanese troops, which were located only 30 miles from our base. Now, you can't fly directly to a target 30 miles away because you never get up to elevation in time. Actually, on our first mission, we flew 20,000 feet. We had to fly way out over the ocean before we could fly back to this Japanese target, which was only 30 miles from where we were based. We bombed a target 30 miles north of us, an island called Arakabisan. Arakabisan, a lot of military installations there. There were a few anti-aircraft explosions directed towards us, but they didn't amount very much. We dropped our bombs there. I don't know whether we hit the target or not. I couldn't see. But I have to tell you what happened 45 years after that. 45 years after we had bombed Arakabisan north of Angaur, where we were based, my wife and I came with a number of middle-aged 494th pilots and with their wives. We stayed at a nice five-star hotel on that exact spot that we had bombed 45 years ago. An amazing thing. And to think that we had dropped bombs in that very spot 45 years ago was very interesting. But we didn't come back there 45 years later to see that spot where we had dropped. We came back there to see where we were based, 30 miles south of there on that little island in the Palau Island. So we got back there 45 years later to the very spot where we had been based for 7 months.
Can you describe what a milk run is? And do you recall some of those missions?
A milk run is the easiest bombing mission you can possibly take, and we love those. A milk run was simply a mission where you took off, you dropped your bombs on the target, and you came home. That's a milk run. No anti-aircraft fire and no enemy planes. Wonderful type of mission. We loved them.
I'm Craig Blumenschein. We continue with our special Veterans Day edition of Main Street and the engaging conversation with World War II navigator Rolf Slem. The event was part of History Night this past February at the Fargo Air Museum, and the session was moderated by Max Sabin of the Fargo Air Museum.
Do you recall any difficult missions? And if you are willing, do you recall any one or two of them that really stand out to you?
Yeah, I can remember a number of them. I better start at the beginning. On Christmas Eve Day, 1944, We had the best meal I ever had overseas. We had turkey and mashed potatoes and vegetables and gravy and stuffing. A wonderful meal, Christmas Eve Day, 1944. But a few hours after that, we got a message, you've got to fly on Christmas Day, and your target is a target called Mabalacat. Mabalacat was a very large Japanese airbase on Luzon. Luzon was the most northerly of the big islands in the Philippines. The Japanese were there and controlled all of that area. General MacArthur had landed with his troops in the central area of the Philippines, but the Japanese were still in full control of the northern part of the Philippines. We were awakened about 2 o'clock Christmas Day morning, ate breakfast, rode out to the flight line with our in trucks, got on our airplanes. Our airplanes had been loaded with bombs during Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, filled with gas, bombs and plenty of gas. And we took off on this, what turned out to be a 14-hour flight up against Mabalacat. We were told ahead of time that Mabalacat was surrounded by all kinds of anti-aircraft guns and plenty of Japanese fighter planes. So we knew it was going to be a tough one. We got up there. I think we had just dropped our bombs and were turning away. And suddenly my co-pilot yelled at me and said, "Hey, Swan, look at this." And I got up and I looked out his window. Here were a bunch of Japanese planes about 2,000 or 3,000 feet above us, and they were dropping phosphorus bombs on top of our formation. And these phosphorus bombs would explode above us, above our formation. And when they exploded, they would send down long streamers of white phosphorus. The idea, I guess, I don't think they were very effective, but the idea was for these streamers to hit our planes and burn holes in those planes. I watched this and I thought, wow, this is just like a Hollywood movie. Japanese planes up here, long explosions of bombs, long streams of phosphorus coming down through our formation. And then the wonderful P-38s, the American fighter plane, they came way down from way above the Japanese planes. They came screaming down towards these Japanese planes. It was just like a Hollywood movie. I was entranced watching the whole thing. It wasn't until I got home from that mission I realized, hey, this is trouble. This looks bad. So we didn't lose a single plane on that mission. Some of the planes, I think we got a few little flak holes in our airplane, but it didn't amount to much. It wasn't until I got home from that mission that I realized, hey, this is dangerous. All that stuff. It wasn't a Hollywood movie at all.
You mentioned during that mission that you encountered Japanese aircraft and flak. Was it pretty common to encounter that while on missions? Do you have any particular stories of any close calls with flak or Zeros or any of those Japanese aircraft of that time?
Yeah, I sure do. This was Christmas Day. We didn't lose a single plane. A few planes got flak holes in them, but nothing very dangerous. But on January 2nd, 1945, we flew another mission up in that very same area against Clark Field. Clark Field had been taken by the Japanese from the Americans early on in the war, and they still occupied Clark Field. We went up there on another long 14-hour flight, where you got up at 2 in the morning and didn't get home until 10 at night. We refueled at a base in between, but those were long, long flights. This was another one. What happened was we got up there and were going to bomb Clark Field, but there was an undercover layer of clouds preventing us from dropping our bombs. We didn't have any radar in those days. Amounted to anything. A decision was made by somebody that we'll fly over the target, but we won't drop our bombs. We'll make a huge turn, the entire 24-plane group make a huge turn, and then come back over the target. Hopefully the clouds will be gone by that time and we'll drop our bombs at that time. Well, we did. We dropped our bombs, but on the shortly after dropping our bombs, first of all, I have to say, I was down in the well of the plane holding the bomb bay doors open because there was some danger that the doors might close accidentally. So I was holding the bomb bay doors open with a lever, and I was looking down out of the bomb bay, and here there was a big explosion, a lot of ack-ack, a lot of flak. The exploding anti-aircraft shells were very close. You could even smell the cordite from the exploding Japanese shells. I drifted into the bomb bay. It is not a nice smell. I almost threw up. But I stayed down there in the bomb bay, and there was a big explosion, and I looked out, and here was a silver wing of a B-24 floating underneath our plane. About the same time, I also saw a huge orange explosion below us. Then, shortly thereafter, a white parachute passed into my view. This white parachute, holding a man, fell into this huge orange explosion and burned up. And I could see the man falling like a rock down to the jungle below. This is very scary, of course. What stuck with me for many years afterwards were the colors. Here was the silver wing. Here was the orange explosion. Here was a white parachute. Here was the green forest down below. And I never could get those colors out of my mind.
You mentioned in the previous that you had been escorted by P-38 Lightnings. Was it pretty common to be escorted into action by P-38s or P-51s or any other type of aircraft?
Mostly P-38s. Now, there were some P-51s, too, later on in 1945. We all thought that P-51 was the most beautiful fighter plane ever invented, and it still is a beautiful plane. Let me tell you about one other mission. It was a mission against a village by the name of Bam Bam, B-A-M-B-A-N. Kind of an odd name for a village, but there it was. The reason we were going after that village was because we were told there was a large Japanese military presence there and we were supposed to bomb them. Well, what was so interesting about the mission was that about 2 minutes before I thought we were going to get there, my bombardier said, "Here it is. I think this is it." Well, I was flabbergasted. I was sure there was still at least 2 minutes to go. And here he said he claimed he saw the target right below him. And I didn't know what to say. Am I wrong? Is my navigation wrong? Is he looking at the wrong place? I finally stopped talking to him because I didn't know. He could see better than I could. So I just held my breath. I thought, I can't believe it. Well, what he saw was another village, which was very similar to the village we were supposed to bomb. And seconds went by. Nothing happened. Total silence on the intercom. More seconds went by. Nothing happened. Finally, he said, "Here it is." It turned out to be Bam Bam, and we dropped our bombs there and went home. The scary part of this mission was, what if he had dropped his bombs on the wrong village? He could have killed dozens of Filipinos. And they, of course, were our friends during World War II. But he got the right village, but he told me afterwards, I was within a hair's breadth of dropping our bombs on the wrong target. Can you imagine he might have had to live with that the rest of his life? Might have killed dozens of people.
Oh, in total, how many missions did you?
We flew a total of 40 missions. When we first got over there, we were told we only had to fly about 35, but it was later changed to 40. So we knew at all times that after we had finished 40 missions, we could go home. I want to mention something first to tell you the significance. Early on in the war, it was told to the American people that a Japanese battleship by the name of Karuna had been bombed by an American bomber pilot named Colin Kelly. He was supposed to have flown his B-24 or whatever he was flying right down the smokestacks of this Haruna battleship. This would have been early 1942 or late 1941, shortly after Pearl Harbor. That was totally false. There was no truth whatsoever to this story about bombing the Haruna. I know that to be true because on our 36th mission, we were told to go up to Curie Harbor, K-U-R-E, Curie Harbor, and bomb the Haruna. The Haruna had been active as a Japanese battleship all during the war. It had never been bombed by Colin Kelly. So the Haruna was our target, and it was by far the worst mission we had ever done. Our 36th mission. I want to get back to the Lonesome Lady, because on that mission, our 36th, we flew a different plane. The Lonesome Lady was flown by a Tom Cartwright flying his second mission. He and his crew were a replacement crew. They were shot down on this mission. They were flying right next to us. They were shot down on this mission. People saw parachutes coming out of his plane. His plane lost altitude, finally disappeared in the clouds, and we got home. That was July 28th, 1945. The war in Europe had been over for a couple months, but the war in the Pacific was going full blast in July of 1945. This is a long story, but what happened to the Lonesome Lady? It went down, but what happened to the crew? Did they get out? What happened to them? Did they live? Many years later, information trickled back to us about the fate of the Lonesome Lady and the fate of that crew. As it turned out, pilot and the tail gunner of the Lonesome Lady survived the war. All the rest of that crew were killed when the atomic bomb landed on Hiroshima on August 6th, 1945. Tom Cartwright, who I met many years later, I didn't know him at the time, became a professor down in Texas. I forget the name of the college. He wrote a book about the fate of the Lonesome Lady, and the name of the book that he wrote was A Date with the Lonesome Lady. And so he had survived that mission. He got out of that plane. He was the last one out, and he survived. He was questioned by the Japanese military fairly close to where he got out, where he landed. He just told them everything he knew, which wasn't much. He didn't know anything except where he had flown from. And many of you probably remember that you're only supposed to talk about your name, rank, and serial number. Well, that wasn't applicable at the time. He told them everything he knew. They didn't believe him. So they took him up to Tokyo for more questioning. And he told them everything he knew, where he had flown from, how they got hit and everything. They didn't believe him then either. They were going to behead him up there in Tokyo. But this was near the end of the war, and I think they were afraid of retribution if they started killing American prisoners. Now, what's also interesting is the story of the tail gunner of Tom Cartwright's plane, The Lonesome Lady. The tail gunner, as soon as that Lonesome Lady was hit, he was out. He played real fast. He got out faster than the rest of the crew. He landed quite a distance from where the Lonesome Lady fell and crashed. He landed on top of practically on top of a mountain, and he immediately took his parachute off, hid it in the brush someplace, and survived on top of this mountain by doing his best to evade search parties who were looking for him. They knew he had crashed, had landed there, but they couldn't find him. He hid away from them, but he got so hungry, absolutely starved, that he walked down, if you can believe it, he walked down this mountain. He got on a Japanese train and surrendered to a military guy on top of this train. They took him, I think, to Yokohama. So he was nowhere near the Hiroshima where many of the other men were imprisoned. And all of the crewmen who were imprisoned in Hiroshima all died when the American B-29 and Nola Gay dropped that one bomb on Hiroshima. They all died there along with several hundred thousand Japanese civilians. I met Tom Cartwright years later at one of our reunions. He had acquired somewhere along the line pieces of the Lonesome Lady. How he had gotten these pieces, I don't know. But I've got a piece of the Lonesome Lady right here. It's right in front of us. I think it's a piece from the tail section of the Lonesome Lady. I finally asked him, can I have it? And he said, yeah, okay. So I took it, and there it is, a piece of the Lonesome Lady right there by those photographs.
Where were you when you heard the news of the atomic bomb drop and the end of the war?
Okay, I've got to try to remember this. The time the Lonesome Lady was shot down, the mission was July 28, 1945. The atomic bomb was dropped in Hiroshima August 6, 1945, when the Americans were killed in that explosion. I was on Okinawa, where we were based at that time, flying missions against Japan and a couple against Japanese targets in China, too. When I heard the news of the dropping of this atomic bomb, I just could not believe it. How could one bomb do all that damage? It was unbelievable. We flew missions after that. In fact, we flew one mission the day after the atomic bomb was dropped, and we came within 60 miles of Hiroshima. I looked and looked and looked. I wondered if I could see anything over there. I couldn't see a single thing. So between the time the atomic bomb dropped, August 6th, the next, we flew some more missions. One night, I was sitting on a bench watching an outdoor movie on Okinawa. I don't remember what the movie was. But suddenly I heard some commotion outside the area of the movie. And then people started yelling, the war is over, the war is over, the war is over. Couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe this war that we had been fighting for months was over. Tremendous emotional letdown. I left the movie. I went back to our tent. And then the dumbest thing that the Americans ever did, I think, they started shooting anti-aircraft missiles off in celebration of the end of the war, August 12th. And these missiles, the exploding shrapnel from these anti-aircraft guns that were being shot off to celebrate the end of the war, missiles, particles of these exploding anti-aircraft bombs came down on the Americans, located on Okinawa. A just unbelievably stupid thing to do. We didn't get hurt, but it was reported later that almost 20 Americans died from falling anti-aircraft shrapnel. That was celebrated at the end of the war. So we thought the war was over, August 12th. It was not over. What had happened was the Japanese had offered to surrender on August 12th. As far as we were concerned, the war was not, as far as the American government was concerned, the war was not over. They offered to surrender August 12th, but the offer of surrender was not accepted by us until August 15th. So between August 12th and August 15th, we flew our 40th mission. Can you imagine? We still were fighting that war tooth and nail, even after the Japanese offered to surrender.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Daybook for Veterans Day. I'm Ann Alquist. I visited with the head of reference services, Sarah Walker, at the Heritage Center in Bismarck to learn more about two veterans she interviewed as part of an oral history project, Nathan Goodiron and Thelma Saxby.
Base camp was pitch black at night. You know, I wasn't at one of those big ones. I was on a smaller one, you know, so pitch black and all that. And so when I got there, big difference. There's no difference, you know. So when I got to Vietnam, it was like being back home. I was still no electricity and no running water, but we had sea rats, you know. So we were busy all the time. So I didn't have time for all that, you know. But talking about veterans, we were in my mother, but in my father's side, we go way back. If you look at the book in there, we go back to Little Bighorn and before that.
I met Paul through a different interview I did. Paul's son, Nathan, was in Afghanistan and was one of our casualties from North Dakota, from this area. And talking to Paul, he came in to do this interview. He was so excited to share about what he had experienced. He was so proud of what he had done to what his son had done as well. And he was a firecracker. He has since passed away, and I'm really glad that we have this history with him.
So let's talk about our next veteran, a woman, Thelma Saxby. This clip that we're going to hear from her was about delivering babies. She saw a lot of deliveries with the military brides when that was part of her service.
She had a weak uterus, so she was bedbound. The story back on medical was she was just full of gas and they couldn't do anything to get rid of the gas. And I told her to stick her butt up in the air. And she couldn't wait until the visitors had left. She made quite a racket. But her baby was born early. She wasn't stillborn. She was very lively.
So what I love about Thelma is about the day-to-day life of military service.
The day-to-day matters are not always the same as seeing combat, as being a POW, or experiencing some of those really horrific parts of war. But I think that there was a lot of honor in that for all of these men and women.
Sarah is going to take us out.
Today's Dakota Datebook, collected by me, Sarah Walker.
And I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that brings us to a close on this special Veterans Day edition of Main Street. From all of us at Prairie Public, we extend our heartfelt gratitude to the veterans, active duty service members, and their families for their unwavering dedication and sacrifice. Today and every day, we honor your courage and commitment. Thank you for your service. Thank you for joining us on Main Street today, and we look forward to spending time together again tomorrow.